Must be no, let's see if this thing will work here. Yeah. We're doing the so-called poetic books. Those five books right there, spending 13 weeks on them. We've done Job a couple weeks. Obviously, this is kind of an overview. We just did a few Psalms. We're doing Song of Solomon right now. And that's the schedule there. So last week we did Song of Solomon. And we just talked about what it says. And we're going to kind of start off there today with what it says and then get into what it means. And I'm going to tell you two interpretations in somewhat detail. And then next week I'm going to argue for the one that I prefer. And you can see the rest of the plan there. So we're talking about Song of Solomon. We believe Solomon wrote it. I believe he wrote it at least. So we kind of need to think about his life, which of course is very unfortunate. Started out pretty good. He started ruling as king. We don't know exactly how old he was when he started. Let's guess 20, and we can fill out the rest of the stuff. He loved the Lord, and God appeared to him, you know, and gave him promise that he'd give himself. He asked for wisdom. So, he seems like he's pretty in fellowship with God at that point. And then he started building a temple, the temple in the fourth year of his reign. He finished the temple in the 11th year of his reign, and he finished his own house in the 20th year of his reign, and he moved his wife into it. It looks like he only has one wife at this point, which was the daughter of Pharaoh. And then right here, there's that prayer he prays in 1 Kings 8, that if you read it, you know, the whole chapter is the prayer. It's for God to inhabit this new temple and to deliver Israel, basically. And God appeared to him a second time. So what I'm working up to is I'm assuming, really the Bible didn't say this, that he was in fellowship with God, not sinless, but in fellowship with God during that time. And then if we go to after that time, it's after that that he gets really, really rich and famous, and he starts marrying foreign wives, and he starts multiplying horses. 1 Kings talks about, and of course 1 Kings is alluding to the fact that they weren't supposed to have or trust in horses for warfare, but he was doing that, and he was disobeying God in both those things. He worshiped other gods at some point. His wives drove him to do that. And so this is again my assumption, he's out of fellowship with God at that point. So he died after a 40-year reign. So if he started reigning at 20, he was about 60 years old. And it's not clear, the Bible doesn't tell us what his relationship with God was like toward the end. But I think that he repented. I think we can hear that in Ecclesiastes with him talking about, basically confessing to us and advising us of all the bad things he tried. Now, none of them worked out. And really all that matters is God and his law. So I suspect he wrote Proverbs early in this time when he was in fellowship with God and probably wrote Ecclesiastes right here at the end of his life as an old man. And just guessing that Song of Solomon is between those two. The reason I guess that is there's a line in there in 6:8 that says he has 60 queens and 80 concubines. But if you know, by the end of his life, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. So Song of Solomon must have been written early in that wife-gathering period, which would be right there where the name of that is. So, okay. So like I said, we talk about, you know, it's hard to agree on or even understand what it means. But we talked about what it said. And so last week we tried to summarize what it said. And the next bullets here are a statement of that I think we could all agree on. That it's about a man and a woman who are in love, that desire each other sexually. In the book there are hints of restraint and of sexual activity. Words like she's a garden locked and she's saving up her love for somebody. She's a wall. And then there's lots of places where she's frustrated in the book because she can't be with her lover. She's in love with this guy and she wants to be with him. There's lots of sections in there that sound like dreams where she's relating maybe some of the dreams that she had. There's a passage in there right in the middle of the book where a caravan from Jerusalem appears, and it's Solomon's caravan, and it's really obviously Solomon, so this is where he obviously comes into the book, and it has something to do with the marriage. There's Solomon wanting a woman sexually, and it described pretty explicitly what she's like, and finally, There's a moral at the end in 8:7, which says, many waters cannot quench love. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. And I think whatever interpretation we come up with, it needs to make sense of that moral, because that does seem to be some sort of summary statement to me. So I showed you this outline. Say it's tentative because it's really pretty hard to do. But we had five sections, and three of the sections ended with one verse that talked about not arousing or awakening my love. And then you can see other things in there. So I want to go through the song again. I'm not going to read it to you like we did last week. It only takes about 12 minutes to read if you want to read it. And I've got in the verse that I mistakenly left out last week. But I want to talk through it, and just to get fresh on our minds what it says, and then we'll look at a couple different ways people have interpreted it. So talking through that first section, she starts off and she's talking about her beloved here. She's talking about how wonderful he is, talking to him about him. And in the middle of that, she says, the king has brought me into his chamber. And I pointed out last week, the text here, the blue parts are tell you whether it's a man or a woman or a group of people talking to a man or a woman, etc. You can tell some of that from the grammar of the Hebrew. And the green we identified last week as a place where she's talking about her beloved, and we circled the king. So a lot of these things, in addition to the text, are stuff we came up with last week, just reviewing that. So the woman's talking to or about her beloved. And then she goes on, and this is where she talks about, she's don't stare at me because I'm swarthy. The sun has burned me. Her brothers were angry with her and made her work in the vineyard. So she's talking about how she looks. And then she changes into talking to her beloved, wanting to know where he pastures his flock, because she wants to be with him. And then there's this, if you don't know, go on the trail of the flock. And then there's this a man talking, this verse about the mare among the chariots of Pharaoh, and let's just go on. So then the woman talks again about her beloved and what he's like and how much she likes him. And she mentions the king while she's doing that. And then she continues talking about how much she likes her beloved, and she says she's the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. And then she's talking about her beloved and how wonderful he is here. And that underlined part is repeated later. It's probably some sort of refrain. I'm not going to have any suggestions about what it means, but we just noted that. So, and then we come to this verse that appears three times in the book where it says, it's apparently Solomon, I think, says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the hinds of the field, that you not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. We talked about the fact last week there's different ways to translate that. I argued for that translation right there, but again, it sort of fits in with that theme of dreams that are going on in this thing. So section one, we just talked through. We've seen this is, again, what it says. There's a country girl, and she has some overbearing brothers that made her work in a vineyard. She's in love with her beloved, whom she describes as a shepherd. She's longing to be with him. She mentions the king has brought her into his chambers. So that's what the first part says. And then we come to the second part. She's talking about her beloved coming, and especially that part down there where he's standing behind a wall and looking through windows and peering through lattice. It starts to sound like a dream. There's later episodes that are going to sound more dreamlike, but this is one of those. I think she's dreaming that he's coming for her. She is saying here what he says. So I'm using the font for her, which is that font, whatever you call it. And I've got it dark because I have them in dark font here. But so she's quoting her beloved here, and he's wanting her to come out and be with him, and the time is right, and et cetera. But this is probably part of that dream that she's dreaming. And the beloved wants to see her in the secret place and be with her alone. So then there's this weird verse, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes running the vineyard while our vineyards are in blossom. That must mean something. And then she talks about beloved is his, and then I'll just not comment the rest of that. So then we come to another dream section where she, the woman, is talking about her beloved, and she talks about how night after night on her bed she was seeking him, and then she talks about going out, and the watchmen of the cities of the city see her, and she asks him if they've seen him whom her soul loves. So she's looking for her beloved, or dreaming she's looking for her beloved, and then she finds him, and she takes him into her mother's house, and then here's that phrase again that we think is the end of a section about not waking her up. And so summary of section two, the girl dreams time has come for her to be with her beloved, and he's come for her and wants to be alone with her. And then another dream, the second one, she's dreaming she's searching for him, and she finds him and takes him into a room in her mother's house. Then we come into section three, which starts off with this part that Solomon's clearly introduced. He may be a part of this before, but he's actually named here. And so there's a caravan coming from Jerusalem, apparently to Lebanon. And he's riding in a couch that some other men are carrying. And let's see, they go on down. It describes the couch that he's on. And he has a crown, the last four lines there. He has a crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. So this has something to do with the wedding. And then we, for the first time, we hear this male voice, which I think later is pretty clear as Solomon, who's praising a girl in pretty explicit terms. He starts off less explicit here, getting more explicit as we go. But she's beautiful. He's talking about her hair, her teeth, let's see, her lips, her mouth, her veil, her neck, and then her breasts, ultimately. And so that's that. And then the woman says to a man, until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, and that's a verse that's repeated. Then a man, I think Solomon again, he's talking about here, and I apologize, but I left this section out. I was really impressed that Gretchen caught that I left it out last week. But anyway, he's going on praising her. This is where we get the specifics about Lebanon being a part of this here. And she's made his heart beat faster. You know, he wants her. She's beautiful. Her love is beautiful. And then it goes on where, about the fifth line, yeah, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. So something's locked up for this guy, apparently. And you know, metaphorically, we got to talk about what that means eventually. But there's a garden locked. And then it comes, right after that, the woman's talking to the wind, and she wants the wind to blow out the smell of her garden so that her beloved will come into his garden. So apparently it's not locked anymore. And then there's a man talking where he has come into the garden. And then there's this statement by a group of people, eat, friends, drink, imbibe deeply, O lovers. It just about everybody agrees. That's probably metaphorically for the consummation of what is going on here. So summary of section three, we see King Solomon riding an exquisite sedan chair amid a large caravan of warriors with great pomp and circumstance. He's wearing a crown given to him by his mother on his wedding day. He's describing the body of a woman, presumably it's a girl, but that is an interpretation, whom he desires sexually. And then we see a woman, presumably that same girl, wishing the wind would blow the fragrance of her garden to her beloved, causing him to come enjoy its fruits. And just, you know, we kind of tipped my hat last week about what I think about this. But in these explanations here, I'm leaving Solomon and the beloved separate. You know, ultimately the one interpretation is to assume that her beloved is Solomon, and you could put his name in each of these, but that's an interpretation. So right now she's wishing that her beloved, whoever he is, would come enjoy the fruit. And then her beloved does come into the garden and they partake. And I guess this is section four. So she's dreaming again pretty explicitly here. She says she's asleep. And she hears the beloved. He wants her to come out and be with him. And she says, hey, I've already gone to bed. I've taken on my dress. I've washed my feet. How can I get up and do this again? And then she feels bad about having answered that way. She gets up to go out, and she opens the door, but he's gone. And so she goes out and looks for him, and the watchmen this time strike her. They take her shawl away, and she talks to the daughters of Jerusalem, whoever that is, that she wants them to help her find her beloved because she's lovesick. So she's looking for her beloved. And they say, well, what kind of beloved is your beloved? O most beautiful among women, what kind of beloved is your beloved that you adjure us thus? So basically, you know, well, who is your beloved? What's he look like? And she describes him, dazzling and ruddy, and, you know, so she's obviously infatuated with him too. And some description of his body, but not near as sexually as the description of hers. And he's gone to his garden, and to his garden again. Then just out of nowhere comes this man's voice again that I think is Solomon, where he's talking about how beautiful she is, how awesome she goes, her eyes, her hair, her teeth, let's see, your temples. And then this is still the man talking, but he's talking about the harem and what they say about her. And the harem even says, you know, she's beautiful. And then the woman says this, I'll read because I think is important. I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranates had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people. And then some people saying, come back, come back. It apparently has something to do with being on that chariot. That's really cryptic, but it probably is important. And then the man again, this time it's clearly Solomon, is talking to the woman, and he's getting more descriptive sexually, let's say. He's talking about her feet, her hips, let's see, her hands, her navel, her belly, her two breasts, her neck. And then he goes, and he says, this is where I say it's Solomon. He says, the king is captivated by your tresses. So I think this is clearly Solomon at this point, talking to the girl, saying that she's beautiful. And he says something weird there toward right in the middle, that she's like a palm tree, and he wants to climb this tree and get the fruit of it. And, well, he wants to do that. And she then says, well, the wine goes down gently for my beloved. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. And then she goes on talking to her beloved. Let's go out in the country and see whether the vine has budded. That's got to mean something. We should interpret that some way. She wishes he was like a brother, because if he was her brother, she could hug him in public and kiss him in public, and nobody would care. But she can't do that as it is now. And then this last little tagline again about not waking her up until she pleases. So that was a long section, but she dreams he's searching the streets after dark looking for her beloved, and she gets beaten up. The daughters of Jerusalem want to help, and they ask her what it's like, and she says he's like a handsome shepherd. And then we see him praising her, and then we see her calling her beloved to join her in the country. And then the last section, finally, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? So finally, we see these two clearly together instead of her looking for him. And then some more stuff, and I'll come back to some of that verse in a minute, so I'm going to skip it now. And then she's quitting her brothers here, remembering how a long time ago her brothers had wondered if she would be promiscuous. It was what I think that's talking about. Let me just use her words. If she's a wall, we'll build a battlement of silver. But if she's a door, we'll barricade her. And she goes on and say, I was a wall. And Solomon really, I won't paraphrase. Solomon had this vineyard. He's coming into here somehow. And he gave her a vineyard with 1,000 shekels for her, but the 1,000 shekels are for him. And then she, this is the end, she calls for her beloved to be with her quickly, and that's it. So, summary of that last section, we finally see that with her beloved, she makes a moralizing statement that I read earlier, for love is as strong as death. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. So summarizing, what does it say? I think she remembers how when she was young, her brothers used to wonder whether she would be a wall or a door, and she says that she was a wall when she grew up. And Solomon wanted her, and it ends with her calling her beloved to join her. So what do we conclude? I'm not really asking you, I won't make you talk yet. I think what I conclude, ladies, is we have a song which at face value seems to be about a girl and her beloved, The girl wants to be with her beloved, but there are various objects preventing them getting together. Yeah, that's clearly a part of it. The song seems to teach somehow this moral, and that's that. So that's what it says, and obviously we wonder what it means. So I showed these slides last week. I'll go over them again. There have been lots of different ways. You can find hundreds of ways to interpret this, but they fall into three groups, allegory, typology, and historical. Allegory is, there's not much allegory in the Bible, but allegory is where things represent other things, let's say. And one example of allegory is there in Judges 9, where the people of one city, I've forgotten what city, are telling a story, and they say, once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and the trees said to the olive tree, reign over us. Well, we know that trees don't talk to trees, and trees don't have kings, and so that's absurd. And that's the way you recognize allegory, is by the absurdity of a literal translation. And so in allegory, the things represent other things. And in that allegory in Judges, I've forgotten exactly what represents what. Typology is similar but different. Similar in that things represent things. But this time we have real people who really existed, like Solomon or like David or Abraham. And those people, or Melchizedek, for example, typify some future person. Let me just read what I said there. It's probably better than me paraphrasing it. In typology, the story is about real people and events. The historical people and events symbolize something or foreshadow something. So people who see this book as typology see the real-life guy named Solomon representing God. Usually they see this. And his real-life lover being the church. So this is a story about God and the church, and the church is honoring God. In fact, I'll show you a typology of details about that in a minute. Another way, more recently, this hasn't gone on for thousands of years, but hundreds of years. People have tried to interpret literally, and generally it falls into two categories, a so-called two-character interpretation, in which we assume that Solomon is this beloved. It's the same guy. So you have to go back and reread the whole thing, substituting his name for everywhere I said the beloved. But a three-character interpretation assumes there's three people in this story, and there's the girl, and there's her beloved, which is a literal shepherd, and there's this King Solomon, this really powerful guy who tries to take her into her harem, but she remains true to her beloved. So two-character interpreters usually try to identify good principles for a good courtship or marriage. In our unbuttoned sexually 20th century, people even found principles for good sex. I'm not going to talk about any of that. One thing you may have heard about is that people think it symbolizes a Syrian wedding feast. There was this guy, Wittgenstein or whatever, who lived in Syria. He was a diplomat in Syria. And he observed in the 1800s some wedding feasts of the Syrians. And they went on for 7 days, and they had various songs. And the girl and the guy getting married were even portrayed as king and queen. And so, anyway, some people think that he observed in the 1800s would be equivalent to what happened 3,000 years before. The three-character interpretations see the book as a picture of the strength of true love between the woman and her shepherd lover, and her love couldn't be bought even by the richest man in the world. So today, I want to look at two interpretations quickly, and I want to try to do them justice. And there may be places in here where you think I'm chuckling at it, but I'm not. I want to be respectful, because this is a These are respectful interpretations. The one will be typology, and then after that we'll do the more recent one from Dallas Theological. So next week I'm going to tell you why I think the three-character interpretation is right. So this one here is real common, probably the most common way this has been interpreted over the year. I'm going to show you the words in blue. They're going to be Matthew Poole's words, not mine, and I'll let him talk. So starts off, May he kiss me with the kiss of his mouth is the beginning line. Now, we're assuming this is typology for something. So all this is going to be typology. I want to try to go slow here and get us in the hang of it. So what or who would be the greatest marriage ever? Christ and the church. So maybe this applies to Christ and the church somehow. So that's the answer. And if that was the case, what would this typify about the church and Jesus? And what he says is that the church desires the graces and comforts of the Spirit of Christ. That's his interpretation of that verse there. And then there's that part about how she's been sunburned and don't stare at me. I thought I had a question there. But anyway, he says that represents the persecutions of the church. So let's just go back and think about this. So we decided that we got the church, we got God, we got the church wanting to be with God. And the church is talking about getting sunburned and, you know, some sort of a trial going on here. Anyway, he says this represents persecutions the church suffered. The sons, he says, represent false brethren who corrupt the church, and we need to deal with false brethren. She asks, where do you pasture your flock? At noon? And he says, well, noontime is when persecution is hard to discover. Persecution is around, and it's hard to discover the true church. Go forth on the trail. Well, that's advice that if you want to find Jesus, you should follow the path of the sheep who had trodden before you. And then she asked to be sustained with raisin cakes and will be refreshed with apples. What refreshes us and sustains us and nourishes us? Obviously, it's the Word. And it is the quickening influence and the Spirit sustains the church. So, summary of the first part, according to that interpretation, is the church is separated from Christ, which is true, and suffering persecution, which is true. The church is sustained by grace, the Word and the Spirit. All that's true. And then the first chapter is just an illustration of this, basically. So it goes on, listen, my beloved, he's coming. And this is talking about Jesus' second coming, and the church is highly anticipating his second coming. Beloved said to her, arise, my darling. This is the woman quoting the man, I think. And Jesus is telling the church, yeah, so let's go back and think about this. He's telling her to arise. Well, what does it imply? Like she's in bed, like she's being lazy. The interpretation is Jesus wants the church to shake off the sloth of the world and the snares of the world. Catch the foxes for us. He says that the foxes are false teachers, and we've got to catch them before they grow. On my bed night after night, I sought him. Well, the church is in tribulation, and in time of tribulation, we should seek Christ. And if you can't find him just by like prayer and the Word, then you should go out and do it in public assemblies like we're doing here together. And then she finds him, and that's obviously the promise that Jesus said, those who seek him will find him. So the summary of that part, the church must separate itself from the sins of the world, which is true, and eliminate false teachers, which is true. When we seek Christ, he will manifest his love to us, which is true. Third section, the caravan is, you know, going on here. What's this coming up from the wilderness? And it sort of keys off the wilderness here, where believers are supposed to come out of the wilderness. And so that's what that's about. He's riding in this sedan chair, which has posts of silver that represents ministers, a back of gold that represents the Word, a seat of purple fabric that represents Christ's blood. I don't know how he gets those things, but that's what he said. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. The eyes are teachers of the church, and what's right in front of the eyes is the veil. Well, that's the people that are hearing the teachers. Your neck is like the Tower of David. What's a neck do? It connects the head to the body. So grace of faith unites us. And I wanted to, two breasts, I guess the question is, what are two things that nourish, that are important to us? And obviously it's the two testaments, Old and New Testament. So a garden locked, there's that. This is praising the fact that the church won't admit false teachers. And she's saying, "Awake, wind, and blow out the fragrance of my garden. May my beloved come in." She's wishing for Christ's presence. And then Christ is enjoying, right now, I guess, Christ and the glorified saints are enjoying the works that the church is doing on earth. Summary, the church is the spouse of Christ who keeps herself pure in this corrupt world. That's true. Jesus rejoices at the works and worship she does on earth. I guess that's true. Asleep but awake, a voice, you know, I've taken off my dress. Well, this is the church being sluggish again, and Jesus is calling her, but she's saying, "Hey, I'm in bed, I don't want to get up." And so when that didn't work, he puts his hand through the opening, and the hand symbolizes his spirit. Yeah, he uses his spirit when the word alone won't work to rouse her. And then she gets roused, and she goes and looks for him, but he's gone. This is him punishing her for having been slothful, I guess. And so there's a time where she doesn't really have the comforts of Jesus. And then she goes out, the watchmen are false ministers, and they hinder rather than help people find Jesus. And she wants the daughters of Jerusalem to help her, and they ask, "What kind of beloved is he?" Because they don't know. And so they're false professors because they don't know the excellency of Christ. Solomon says, "You're as beautiful as Tirzah." And so, yeah, so Christ had hid himself, if you remember, let me come back forward. He'd hid himself. Well, now he's coming out of hiding for a while, and he's praising the church, and the 60 queens and the concubines represent other congregations. I don't know how he gets that. They're praising her, who is like the moon. Well, what's the moon do? It has eclipses. So it's talking about the fact that there's times when your spiritual, the church's spiritual relationship can be eclipsed. But it's brought back into Christ's light. How beautiful are your feet and sandals. The sandals, obviously, are the gospel peace. Your hips is the uprightness of her going. And navel has something to do with nourishment. So the church is nourishing many children. Stature like a palm tree, symbol of victory. He's going to climb the palm tree and get the fruits. Christ does climb the palm tree. Let's see. Goes down smoothly. The church is reserving herself for Christ alone. And let's go into the country that I'll give you my love. So the church has been lazy, but now she's aroused and she's earnest about her relationship with Christ. And she wishes he was like a brother. The church wants a closer union with Christ than she's had. So summary of all that, the church has learned to keep her love for Christ fervent. And again, these are words straight out of Matthew Poole's commentary. I don't necessarily subscribe to them. The last section, many waters can't quench love. Love can't be bought. It has to be given is what that means. The little sister with no breasts is a Jewish church talking about the Gentile church. And this stuff about wall or door is a Jewish church wondering if she's going to have faith or if she's not going to have faith. If the Gentile church is going to have faith or not have faith. And the Jewish church was a wall. Hurry, let's get together. Christ is going to leave for a little while. The church will have times, you know, where they want him to come back, but he will come back eventually. So the church loves Christ, and he loves her. She'll wait faithfully until he returns. So you can see how they've taken all those words that we pretty much understand, and they've interpreted them into a relationship of Jesus and the church. Maybe some of you find that satisfying. It's, like I said, by far the most common interpretation. So summary of the whole thing, the church is separated from Christ, is suffering persecution. During this time of separation and grace, the Word and the Spirit sustains the church. The church must separate itself from the sins of the world and eliminate false teachers. When we seek Christ, he'll manifest himself to us. The church is a spouse of Christ who keeps herself pure in this corrupt world. She's learned to keep her love for Christ fervent. She'll wait till he comes back, and Jesus rejoices at her. So that's, according to him, what this song means. I think that's the last line. What's the support for that? Well, the New Testament does call the church the bride of Christ. So there's some support. Yeah, if it's about Solomon's courtship and marriage, It might typify, as we said. And as I said earlier, time, this is by far the most common way to interpret something like this. You could find hundreds of different kinds of interpretations. In fact, I think that's what the next bullet says. These people agree that Solomon is the type of the church. Solomon's the type of Jesus, and the bride is the type of church. But beyond that, they'd have all sorts of different interpretations, so you can even have hundreds of those. And that's the weakness, is you can make a text say just about anything. The Catholics interpret the verse that says your navel is like a round goblet, which never lacks mixed wine, is referring to the baptismal font in the eternal sacrament of the baptismal water. So it's just an example. You can make it say whatever you want. The Jewish people in the 7th century said her navel is a Sanhedrin, which nourishes, because navel has to do with nourishment. So it's kind of unhinged. And problems with that, we have no indication in the Bible or elsewhere that Song of Solomon should be interpreted typologically. Now, I'm sorry I'm having to go fast, but I hope this is interesting. So we're going to shift gears here and come to the Dallas Theological Commentary, which, you know, we respect. It starts off, same verse, may he kiss me with the kiss of his mouth. And we need to shift gears, you know, and start, we were thinking about what typified what. Now we just need to think about, this is a real story about real people who are real in love, and what can we learn about it from principles, etc. So Solomon, expert in sex, which is, say that tongue-in-cheek. That wasn't, by the way, that wasn't in the commentary. I added that. Yeah, this is me talking still. So we need to look, the whole way this interpretation is going to work is we need to look for what this might teach us about courtship, marriage, and sex. So the commentary now, this is a DTS commentary, says this means, this is just talking about the woman desiring Solomon's physical affection. Don't stare at me because I'm swarthy. What would that mean? Here's the question I expected before. So what might this teach us about courtship and marriage? And I've done so much talking, I'm going to pause and see if any of you will talk here. What might that mean in just the literal two-character interpretation? Or how might we apply that? The woman is saying, don't stare at me because I'm swarthy. The sun has burned me. Nobody's going to talk, huh? Okay, that's the answer. She's insecure because she thinks she's not attractive. She's conscious about her appearance. At least that's the interpretation of this commentary. Your cheeks are lovely with orange. This is Solomon talking now, and we're still in that context. So Solomon's talking to this girl that's kind of insecure about how she looks, and he's praising how she looks. That's the answer. And that helps her overcome her feelings of insecurity. And so here she's talking, and she evaluates herself now as the Rose of Sharon. So obviously some of that confidence has worked. And she talks about Solomon, that he's his apple tree and there's shade. So she gets a sense of protection from her man. So summary, what was that first thing about? We see a man and a woman cultivating an intimate relationship. And this commentary says a man should provide, quote, aspects of romantic love which are important to women, unquote. And that would include like a feeling of protection and obvious displays of expressions of love. So maybe so. Listen, my beloved, he's coming. This is a woman just being excited about Solomon coming to visit her. Catch the foxes. She wants Solomon to take initiative in solving problems that are coming up. She's seeking him night after night. She's going to arise and go over the city and seek him. Click twice. Where are we now? Yeah. And this is a dream. And Solomon had come to Lebanon. He'd gone back to Jerusalem. Now she's worried that whether he'll be faithful or not. And so she's seeking him. Summary, we see the intensity of the couple's longing for each other increase. But even such idyllic love has problems that must be addressed, including the woman's fear that her man will not be faithful to her. Third section, this caravan coming up from the wilderness, Couch of Solomon, describes the literal party coming up. No more than that. Here we get Solomon's first description of her. Let's see here. Yeah, about halfway through, this is a commentary talking. In his eyes, she's beautiful, quote, even though she did not meet the objective standards of beauty in her society. So apparently this commentary is assuming that maybe she wasn't in quite that beautiful, but her husband is praising her. A garden locked, he's praising her virginity. Awake, my wind, let the garden breathe out the fragrance. She's inviting Solomon to possess her sexually. And then Solomon comes, and this is referring to the consummation I talked about earlier. So God approves of sex with a marriage. That's one of the conclusions we make. Sex, when properly enjoyed with a marriage, draws attention from one's own self to one's mate. Quote from a commentary. So she's asleep, but she hears him knocking, and she won't get up, and he sticks his hand through the opening. This is talking about indifference that can creep into a relationship after you're married and just take each other for granted. She goes out, and she gets beat up by the watchman of the city, and this may indicate that she was to blame for this emotional separation from her husband, and she needs reconciliation with Solomon. The girls at Jerusalem ask who your beloved is, what is he like, and so it gives her a chance to praise her husband and helps her rekindle her former feelings of love. Here's her husband talking again now, so I guess they're back together, and Solomon takes initiative in praising her in this reconciliation that's going on, and this thing about going down the orchard and has to do with Solomon putting her on his chariot and taking her away. Solomon's talking about how beautiful she is, feet, hips, navel, and it's starting as we go. It's getting more bold sexual description, and how he interprets that as such an increase in sexual freedom is a normal part of a healthy, maturing marriage. So he wants to climb the palm tree, and that's what it means. He wants to enjoy the intoxicating fruit of her love, and so she's secure in his love here, and she can say that his only desire is for her. So apparently she's not worried about him anymore. Liz rises early. So having grown more secure, she feels free to initiate the lovemaking. And summary, this dream symbolizes, and again, this is a dream, I think, symbolizes a pain of separation brought about through her selfishness and dramatized her need of her husband for her well-being and protection. All that was a quote. As a marriage grows through the right responses to trials, the relationship deepens. Of course, that's true. And finally, the last section there about waters quenching love. Love's priceless. How can you have it? I guess it has to be given. This thing the brothers were wondering whether she'd be a wall or a door. Well, they interpret that the way I do, that they're wondering whether she'll be chaste or not. And she says she was chaste. She kept herself pure for Solomon, enabling her to give Solomon contentment, quote unquote. She wants to be with Solomon, wants him to hurry up. She remembers the intensity of their love, and she wants the same intensity now. So we've gone through the whole thing quickly. What do we see in this interpretation? We see a man and a woman cultivating an intimate relationship in which the man provides protection in obvious displays of expressions of love. There are problems in a relationship that have to be addressed, including the woman's fear that her man won't be faithful to her. The pain of separation dramatizes her need for her husband. And as the marriage grows through the responses to trials, it deepens. God approves of sex with a marriage. Sex, when properly enjoyed with a marriage, draws attention from oneself to one's mate. So good aspects. One thing that's good about this is they're trying to interpret it literally. I think that's wise, rather than the allegorically or typologically. And they're trying to draw moral principles from it. You know, I don't necessarily agree with all the things they draw. But in general, one thing when we went to the typology, I kept saying that's true. They're taking things that we know that's true about Christ and the church, or things that we know about that's probably true about husbands and wives, and we're finding those in here in a way. Problems, there's really no historical basis. Think Solomon is not the kind of guy you'd want to use as a man who's going to be faithful in marriage. If he really did have 700 wives and 300 concubines acquired over a period of about 10 years, that's about getting married about once every 4 days or getting a new woman there once every 4 days. So it's unclear how we can really literally think of Solomon as a good example of anything. And nowhere does the text say that the woman's beloved was Solomon. That's why I've maintained that distinction. In fact, we'll talk next week about that. There are clues to the contrary that the woman's beloved is not Solomon. But that's getting into the three character interpretation. So, whatever this means, we could probably find as many interpretations here in this room as we have people if you'd be bold enough to say what you mean. We can all agree it's cryptic, I think. It's not, like Romans, it just comes out and says things in a logical way. And at the beginning of this class, I tried to point out to you that some of the Proverbs are cryptic, and there are some Psalms that are cryptic. I don't think I pointed that out. By cryptic, I mean they say things in a way that has to be really thought about and interpreted. It's just not clear. So for some reason, God's given us part of the Bible like this. It's meant not just to be read and filed away, but to be chewed on and thought about and wrestled with, and we get a meaning from that. So that's my interpretation of that. So for next week, sorry for doing a little talking again this week and going so fast, but I'd like you to read the Song of Solomon again and think about it prayerfully, about what it means to you and what God's trying to say to you in it. And then next week I'll share with you why I think three character interpretation makes the most literal sense and just fits really well. So that's where we're going. So questions or comments? Stuart?
Yeah, one question or comment. With GPS and interpretation, you know, if he wrote it earlier in his life, it would make more sense.
It would, because in fact, people who would buy that DTS interpretation probably would assume that he's talking about his first wife, which is Pharaoh's daughter. And he was apparently married to her solely for about 20 years. The problem I have is so 60 queens and 80 concubines. But again, that's interpretation. Who knows? All we can do is look for these little handles that we can grab onto, and we weight some handles more than others, and it drives interpretation differently. But yes, if we think about Solomon and his first wife, that would be the way to make the DTS one make sense. Yes? Well, a lot of bad things happened. We can talk about the early part of his life where he was assumed in fellowship with God, and then boom, he's out of fellowship with God and really going down the wrong side. It's not just the wives, it's the money and the horses and the wise gods the guy. So do we have any indication? I think you all know as much about that as I do, but I just think as a picture, here's the wisest man in the world. I'll give him that. But even it shows the power of sin. Even he was subject to fall, and he fell pretty badly. Yeah. He even mentioned sex in Ecclesiastes. That he talked about he pursued money and he pursued building, and there's one point where he pursued sex. Is my word, not the Bible. And he says something like, "With my mind and stimulating myself with I think alcohol," he talks about that in Ecclesiastes. So we'll be there in a few weeks. Probably. Yeah. I guess I said something like getting married every 4 days.
Still immoral, but
yeah, well. Okay, so it does say 700 wives and 300 concubines. It says that. So whatever a marriage ceremony was, I don't know. But if marriage ceremony took 7 days, then he'd have, they'd overlap. But I think, and you know, whether what, just what concubines did in the harem, we don't know. We would be depending on other harems of other kings and other times, and yeah, stuff like that would be true. But so, well, that's the best I can do with that. Yes.
Like 700 wives and 300. How big was your bed?
That's pretty good. Mike, yeah, yeah. I did not in this, and I'd have to go back and look to see what he said that meant. I don't remember what he said that meant. Yeah, the King James has the interpretation, don't arouse love until it's ready. You may, if you remember last week, we talked about there's two interpretations. The King James goes for that other one, so Poole would have been using the King James, so his Bible in English would have said, I adjure you, daughter of Jerusalem, don't arouse or awaken love until it's ready. So, I don't know, maybe it's something like, you know, when Jesus comes back, it's going to be ready, you know, and we don't, I don't know. I'll try to look it up. I'll look it up and tell you next week what he says. Okay. I was kind of worried about this class because I don't really feel like there's any part of scripture we've taken said this is the edifying thing you should take home with you. But on the other hand, I hope we've done justice to the Song of Solomon. So I'll just leave it at that. Let's pray. Father, this is cryptic. We wonder why, well, we wonder what it means, and we wonder why it's hard to figure out. We wonder why several of us disagree, but I pray you'd help us to honor your word and honor this book of your word and study it and look for what you're saying to each of us in the book. I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.